Hello and welcome to Two Peds in a Pod, the medical education podcast from the Children's Emergency Department in Derby. I'm Ian Lewins, your host today, and I'm joined once again by my good friend and colleague, Dr. Nigel Ruggins. Good afternoon, Nigel.
Hello, Ian.
So as long as I've known you, we're going to talk about something today which has always seemed to be a passion of yours,
yep.
Which is the care of children with cystic fibrosis.
Absolutely.
So taking it right down to basics, what do we mean? What is cystic fibrosis? What do we mean by that?
Well, first of all, it's a genetic disorder, so it's the commonest autosomal recessive condition in our Caucasian population. But effectively, it's a gene mutation problem that causes an abnormal protein that produces very thick and viscid secretions. And this can be anywhere in the body, from the lungs to the gut. And it's been associated with significant mortality and significant morbidity.
And this is when we're sort of thinking about how this comes to light. This is something that we screen for on the heel prick test, isn't it?
It is. So it's screened for on the newborn screening test. It's a two-stage process. They initially look for something called immune reactive trypsin. And if that is found to be elevated, they'll do a second stage where they look for the commonest mutations associated with cystic fibrosis.
And does that heel prick test pick up all children with CF, or is it some children with CF?
It picks up the majority, okay. So probably over 90%. Some will present in other ways. We have some within our local clinic that have either been diagnosed clinically or not been picked up by the screening.
Okay, so pretty good, actually.
Pretty good.
Okay, so what then happens if the sort of the lab picks up this as a positive thing? What happened? Do you get a phone call to say this child's positive?
So I get a phone call. In the past, it used to be directly to the GP initially, but that just seemed to include a few steps that weren't probably necessary. And then I would arrange to meet the baby and the family. And of course, that initial meeting is quite difficult because parents often have got no idea that anything is wrong with their baby at all. And then to tell them that they've got a potentially life-threatening, life-limiting disease is quite a difficult conversation to have in that first appointment.
And I don't know if you know, what do the parents actually get told prior to them coming? Is it something's been picked up? Do they get a letter from the screening centre? Or?
No, they leave it to us to contact the parents, which is quite difficult. Sometimes I'll give them a ring initially and ask them if they've got any worries about the baby, and then I would say that they have got something that's been picked up on the screening that we need to have a chat with them about and to look at the baby. So I try not to be specific, because the last thing you want them to do is to rush on Google and try and find things out themselves. I've even had one couple that were told that they had a raised IRT, and they came to me because they thought that meant that there was something wrong with the thyroid.
Right.
So I'd had a lot of unpicking to do then. So if they ask you directly, then it's difficult not to give them some information, but I try and do it at that first face-to-face.
Because I guess most people sort of consent to that screening, either A, without really fully knowing what they're consenting to, but I think most people consent in the presumption that it'll be normal.
Absolutely.
Don't they?
And of course, that is true for most of the people.
Yeah.
The information is there about, there's fantastic publications about the conditions that we screen for and why we do it. But, you know, for every individual pregnancy, do we really go through all that? Mm. We just think that it's right to do these things because, you know, we want to the best outcome for our babies, but we don't go in there thinking, oh, I can't wait to know what the result of my CF screening is.
No. Yeah. So they come along to the clinic with sort of a bit of pre-warning.
Yeah.
What sort of things do you do in clinic in terms of sort of history and examination and those sorts of things?
So the first thing, important thing, is that I'm there and I'm prepared with information to back up any discussions that we have. I'm also there with one of our specialist nurses, because I think they often need that bit of extra support once they go home. And initially you are doing an assessment as to whether the baby's thriving. Does it look like it's pancreatic sufficient? Is it overfeeding? Is it having lots of pale stools, offensive stools? And of course, at that time, at a few weeks of age, which is what we're talking about, they won't tend to have any respiratory problems.
Mm. So child's, say the child's thriving nicely, putting on weight, no clinical concerns at all, and you examine them and they examine normally, what would you do next?
So we would try and organise a sweat test on that first appointment.
Okay.
The problem with that is that sometimes you won't always get enough sweat. Mm. We would get a stool sample off and we would do a faecal elastase because that's the best measure of pancreatic function. So that would be abnormal in a baby with CF. But again, you can't just exclude CF on that because we do have a number of patients who have cystic fibrosis proven but are pancreatic sufficient. But it is that pancreatic sufficiency that's the most important thing to manage when they're first diagnosed.
Okay, so it's sort of the gut side of things, the thriving side of things. Actually, chesty-wise, they're unlikely to run into problems this early.
That early, yeah.
And at what stage in that sort of consultation and those investigations do you sit down and go, yes, your child definitely has cystic fibrosis? What are the things you need to sort of tick off, if you like?
Well, sometimes you will have the screening result and it will tell you that they've got the commonest combination and their delta F508 yep. homozygote, and then really your home and dry.
Yep.
It's where they've got some of the rarer mutations where the outcomes are not necessarily as well defined, and officially we would want at least one positive sweat test to tell them they've definitely got cystic fibrosis.
Okay.
But as we learn more about the genetics of this condition, we are starting to unravel certain problematical areas. So we have a class of patients now that we call CF SPIDs,
right.
which sounds a bit weird, but it's cystic fibrosis screen positive indeterminate diagnosis.
Right, okay.
So these are patients that have been picked up on the screening program. So they may have had an abnormal IRT and they've identified CF mutations, but the nature of those mutations, the clinical outcome, is not well defined. So they tend to have a much milder disease generally, or they may have been ones that wouldn't present until perhaps in adulthood or later life.
Right, so really slightly trickier.
Slightly trickier situation to manage, yeah.
Okay, so sweat tests, that's something that you sort of do as a day case thing. What does that involve?
So that really involves, just as it says really on the tin, it's collecting an amount of sweat that you can analyse for the level of chloride and sodium in the sweat. It's a non-painful procedure. You need some form of actually collecting the sweat. We used to use a pre-weighed filter paper and pass a small potential difference across it and collect the sweat that way. These days we've got a much better system where the sweat's collected into a very small coil, and there's a colour dye in it so you can see when you've got enough.
Okay, that sounds better than what I used to do.
It is much better. It's much better.
Okay. And as you say, in those where we're not quite sure, the positive sweat test is you know, that's your diagnostic.
It's still the diagnostic because we can't completely rely on the genetics.
Okay. So that's the very young ones. That's our 90% of the on the screening test. You must, of course, get referrals from GPs saying, look, I've seen this child. He's 3 or 4 or 5. He's always been a bit short. He seems to get lots of coughs and colds. And I'm just wondering, could this child have cystic fibrosis? What would you do in clinic? What sort of things would you be asking in clinic?
So it's about their chest infections, whether they're thriving, whether they've got any bowel symptoms associated with possible malabsorption. Looking at their growth, are they underweight for height? Have they got clubbing when you examine them? Because we have had a couple of patients locally who have been diagnosed because they've got clubbing and at a later age without the diagnosis having been thought of before. So it's those sort of things. And we shouldn't be scared of doing a sweat test. I think we tend to think, well, these children have been screened for at birth these days, but we mustn't be over-reliant on screening. As I've already pointed out, it's not 100%. Yeah. And if the parents have got true concerns and it's been raised with them, sometimes you do a sweat test just to say, look, I don't think it's cystic fibrosis, but we need to be sure because it will affect how we manage the patient. And I think when you look at the current data in our CF patients, obviously in the older ones, nearly 70% of those will have had diagnosis out of the newborn screening period. But of course, the screening programme has changed. It is much more sophisticated now.
And again, you're sort of thinking sweat test for these kids.
Yeah.
I mean, do you ever get kids that walk in and you go, oh, you've got CF?
Yeah, unfortunately. Unfortunately. And then you get that occasional patient. We've had a patient recently that had been investigated elsewhere and came into our emergency department with a chest infection and really chronic changes on chest x-ray. Mm. And he had clubbing, and you thought, you've got to have CF. But actually, his sweat test came back normal. And his faecal elastase was normal, so he was pancreatic sufficient. But we decided, as we were doing our blood test, that we would look to see if there are any other CF mutations there. And in fact, he had a rarer CF mutation profile, which actually made him pancreatic sufficient and gave him a normal sweat test.
Right.
But by diagnosis, he still had cystic fibrosis.
Right.
And he has got significant bronchiectasis and lung disease.
Right. Okay. So if we sort of split it into the how we manage these kids in terms of the chest side of things and the sort of the pancreatic side of things, I think people are fairly, you know, when they think of cystic fibrosis, they think of chest, they think of physiotherapy.
Yeah.
What sort of treatments do you start, and when do you make that decision to start from a respiratory perspective?
So in the past, and traditionally, we've, as soon as a child or a baby has been diagnosed, we put them on flucloxacillin prophylaxis. And this is because the early infections in cystic fibrosis are often associated with Staph aureus.
Yeah.
It's a very nasty, destructive bug. And flucloxacillin is a good narrow spectrum antibiotic against Staphylococcus. And so that was been the traditional way of managing it. There is currently actually a national trial going on to randomise patients to having Fluclox prophylaxis from diagnosis to not. There's been a concern perhaps that earlier acquisition of Pseudomonas and other infections may happen if they've had flucloxacillin prophylaxis. So that's a national trial that's going on at the moment. There's not much physiotherapy that we do with babies. We just show parents how to position them and to help manage their secretions. But as they get older, they showed further techniques, and then we start introducing bits of kits that can help them expectorate and get rid of their sputum, their sticky sputum. And there's a whole gambit of things and techniques that our physiotherapists use to help them do that. And that's all sort of age appropriate, and also giving them a chance to do the treatments themselves.
Okay. So, and I guess it's very much, you know, you've got prophylaxis, and then you treat, you know, each acute.
Absolutely.
Based on, hopefully, some sputum cultures.
Yeah. So obviously they don't produce sputum right from the word go. And we do try and get direction from taking cough swabs. We all know that cough swabs are fairly limited, but they are quite good in terms of correlation with infection in the lower respiratory tract. But if you're treating blindly, then we would tend to use antibiotics that cover the sort of organisms that are common in that particular age group or from that particular individual's history.
And thinking about infections and thinking about bugs, what is it about Pseudomonas that's a particular worry in these children?
Well, yeah, Pseudomonas, the acquisition of Pseudomonas, once you become colonised with it, it is associated with deterioration in lung function, deterioration in nutritional status. But one of the things that has happened since I've been looking after CF is that we've recognised that early Pseudomonas infections are actually different to those that when you become chronically established. And if you aggressively treat those early Pseudomonas infections with nebulised antibiotics and oral ciprofloxacin, we know that you can delay the appearance of Pseudomonas in terms of chronic carriage for a number of years. So that's been a big change. And the longer we can delay patients chronically carrying Pseudomonas, the better the outcome in terms of their overall morbidity and mortality.
Okay, and then just leading on from the nebulized therapy, you used other nebulized medicines sort of acutely, don't you,
yes.
for these children?
Yeah, so things that help break down the sputum and make it much easier to cough up. So there's a medication called Pulmozyme or DNAs, which is a nebulized once a day. It's a mucolytic agent, and studies showed that it improved their lung function by 10 to 15%. It reduced infective exacerbations, and it reduced the need for admissions and IV antibiotics. We also use hypertonic saline, which is, again, it induces the patient to cough and helps them expectorate. So combining this with good physiotherapy is a good way of managing their lung problems.
And do you get sort of very variable, so, you know, no two children with cystic fibrosis, like, do you get very variable? Some children go months and months and years without picking up infections, and others just seem to get infection after infection after infection.
Absolutely, and that variability has been subject to a lot of discussion. You know, are there genetic modulators to, so we know that a patient's Delta F508, but why do some end up on the transplant list at 11, 12 years of age, and why do some go on to adults services with 90% lung function? So the differences between those patients, sometimes there are, you know, clear differences in terms of their ability to do their treatments and the support they get, but other times there doesn't appear to be a great deal of logic to
okay.
it.
Just unlucky.
Unlucky,
okay.
Yeah.
So moving on then to the gut side of things and the pancreatic insufficiency, if I can say it.
Yep.
What are the things that you do for that? How do you help with that side of things?
Well, the simple answer is that they're lacking in enzymes, particularly lipase, that helps them absorb the fat and getting the calories from their nutrition, and therefore you just have to replace that. But that is really oversimple, because clearly it's quite your diet is varied. We want them to have a high calorie diet with lots of fat, so all the sort of things that we would like to eat, like bacon sandwiches, McDonald's milkshakes, all those sort of things, we encourage our cystics to eat, as long as they take enough enzymes to absorb all the calories and the fats with it. So the dietetic input is really important. And we have to teach them a little bit like you do in diabetes, to try and match what you're eating and the fat content with the amount of enzyme that you have to take. But you do have to take enzymes with everything that you're eating that contains those things. Otherwise, you'll get symptoms of diarrhea and tummy ache. And one of the things that our cystics tend to be adherent to is taking their Creon, because right. if they don't, they get nasty
they
symptoms
know.
And they know.
Yeah. Right. So they might miss the odd prophylactic dose of antibiotic,
absolutely.
But they don't miss the Creon.
Okay. Absolutely. Generally.
Yeah. Okay. You touched on sort of transplantation and those sorts of things.
Mm.
Is that something that is common or uncommon, or...
So
do you have to meet
a certain criteria, and as with transplantation of any organ, there's a lack of donors.
Yeah.
I can say that all our data is collected annually on a national CF register, and the register for 2017 has just been published, all the data, and there were 50 odd transplants performed throughout the country. And they will be generally in people who are thought to have less than a year's expectation for survival. We've had two children in our clinic that have gone on and had lung transplants and now are in the adult clinic.
Okay.
So generally their FEV1 has to be less than 30%. They're often oxygen dependent, at least at night, and then they have a lot of other associated CF-related problems.
And of course, I guess the great dilemma with this is you've got to be so bad, but you've then got to wait.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sure there are children who've died waiting on the transplant list.
Absolutely. So I've said we've had two successful. We've had three that have died on the list. We've also had one that was assessed for transplant but not felt to be suitable, because there are certain other criteria. So there are certain infections that these patients might have that are not suitable, do very badly after transplantation because of immunosuppression that they have to have for that.
And is transplantation curative?
No. So if we take the example of one of my patients who had transplant at the age of 15, she, before she had her transplant, she was in oxygen at night. She was having three monthly courses of IV antibiotics. She had CF-related diabetes, so she was on insulin. She'd had a number of spinal fractures because of osteoporosis associated with her insulin. So after a lung transplant, which was successful, and she's now something like 6 years post-transplant, she has got 70-80% lung function. She's not had IV antibiotics for years, but she has still got an insulin requirement because of her CF-related diabetes. She's still got problems with her bones because of osteoporosis. So it, you can't underestimate the change that it can make in terms of their lung function. But it, of course, it isn't a cure for the multi-system disease itself.
Okay. And sort of thinking about older kids, how long do you hang on to your cystic fibrosis patients? Because we talk a lot about transitioning to adult services. Are there adult respiratory physicians who just do cystic fibrosis?
There are now.
Oh, right, okay.
There are now. So just to give you an idea of how things have changed. So when I started looking after cystic fibrosis patients as a registrar in Nottingham with the consultant there, there were no adult patients at all. So anybody that went to 16, 17, she still looked after, and they didn't get further than that. So now there are well-established CF adult clinics. And in fact, you know, for the last few years, on the National Registry, there are more adults with cystic fibrosis than there are children. So over 60% of the CF population in the UK are over 16.
Right.
So we start talking about transition around 13, 14 years of age. And it is a very important thing in CF because we do know that around that sort of time, that teenage time, is associated with a significant challenge to their health, both in terms of compliance and also something around the disease. It just seems to be a difficult time for them, particularly in girls. So there's a big differential now in terms of survival in boys compared to girls. So boys actually do a bit better than the girls, and that's a consistent thing that we've seen in the national data. We're not quite sure what the influences are of it, but that's definitely a true thing. So that transition period is really, really important to manage well. And it's not a sudden thing. It has to happen over a gradual period of time.
Yeah. And, of course, it's not just the child that you're looking after. That you're looking after a family. And do you refer them to genetics, or do you do some of the counselling yourself?
So they're referred to genetics right from the parents are they're introduced to genetics right at the word go. Some of them don't want to take it up at that stage, and then we start talking to our younger adult patients about the implications for their future in terms of, you know, passing the genes on, what sort of things can be done. And some of them at that stage will want to talk with the geneticists. Some of them won't feel, you know, ready to do that. Obviously, there are the issues of impending pregnancies in teenage girls and also our boys, and we have to address those concerns as well and manage those things.
Okay. And I guess just sort of coming finally, despite all the many advances, this is still a life-limiting condition.
It is a life-limiting condition, although, again, on the national survey, the mean predicted survival is now 47 years. Okay. So that's a massive change.
That's a huge change, actually.
That is a huge change. And I think the future is even brighter. So the newer treatments actually looking at... So people were very excited about the possibility of gene therapy. Unfortunately, although theoretically that looked like it was going to be fantastic, it perhaps hasn't produced the dividends. But actually, the new treatments that modulate the way that the CFTR protein works are looking incredibly promising.
Okay. Final question then, which is a bit of a personal question.
Yeah.
Since I've known you, you've always seemed to really enjoy looking after children with cystic fibrosis and their families. Why is that?
I think it's difficult to know, but it is one of those challenging conditions. It's a multidisciplinary and multi-system condition. that you actually get to know these families incredibly well, sometimes a little bit too well. And it's about working with colleagues that are motivated to do the same thing. And that that team working is really important and a really great atmosphere to be working in. And I suppose the other thing is that the changes that I've seen in the outcome of this disease from when I started looking after children as a registrar, senior registrar, to now is actually unrecognisable. It has made a massive difference.
Right, lovely. And I think anybody listening will pick up that enthusiasm and passion that you have. Nigel, thank you so much for talking to us
today. That's a pleasure. Thank you.